So we've just read from the 9th chapter of the Gospel of Luke. And both scholars and saints will tell us that this 9th chapter is the central chapter in the Gospel, not just because it's near the middle of the Gospel, but it marks a significant turning point. And the question that buzzes around this particular chapter is, who is Jesus? Who is this man? The chapter begins with Jesus gathering the 12 disciples together. And we're told that he gives them all power and all authority to cast out demons and to heal the sick. That's verse 1. And verse 2 continues, we're told that he then sent out the 12 to proclaim the kingdom of God and to heal people. And so the disciples do just that. They go out into Galilee, into the towns and villages, proclaiming the kingdom, healing diseases. Because all power and authority have been given to them. Then there's this kind of interesting interlude that's only in Luke's gospel. And we're told that Herod, the ruler, was perplexed about Jesus and who he is. He talks about John the Baptist and he says, well, people are saying that John the Baptist has come back to life because I beheaded him. But who then is this that I hear such things about? And Herod wanted to see Jesus. Then we're told that Jesus took the 12 away to a lonely place. But the crowds heard that he was going there. And so they gathered at that place where Jesus and the disciples had gone. The day grew on, Jesus taught the crowds, he healed the sick. And as evening approached, the disciples came to him and said, Master, this is a lonely place. Send the crowds away so that they can find something to eat, somewhere to stay. And it's only a few days before that Jesus had given them all power and all authority to cast out demons, to heal the sick. They'd already experienced what it was like to have that power and authority. And then when another opportunity arises for them to do just that, the silly disciples just don't get it. They want to send the crowds away. So Jesus says to them, give them something to eat yourselves, because all power and authority have been given to you. Then there's this incident where Jesus gathers the 12 again in private. And Jesus puts the question to them, who do the crowds say that I am? You're one of the prophets, you're Elijah. There's this discussion. And then he turns to the 12. Okay, but you, who do you say I am? So it's the third time in this chapter that this question has been posed. Who is Jesus? Who is this man? And then Peter speaks up. In Luke's gospel he says, you are the Messiah of God. And then Jesus continues then that teaching and he begins for the first time to explain how this is all going to work out. He tells them that he's about to head to Jerusalem, that there he will be betrayed, he will suffer, he will be put to death. And the disciples, of course, are perplexed and he tells them, no, you're not to tell anyone about this. You must take up your cross every day and follow me. That's then the context. That's the background of this particular passage that we have here in 9:28. And Luke links it together. I don't know why the lectionary doesn't give us this detail, but it says then 8 days later, connecting the previous events to this event, when Jesus then goes to the mountain to pray. Because mountains are always that place of encounter with God. And it seems that Jesus, and certainly St. Luke, has in mind those great theophanies, we call them, those moments when God appears to great people in the past. And there were the two famous stories of people who had experienced this previously. The first is in the book of Exodus in chapter 24, when Moses goes up there on Mount Sinai and experiences with three companions the very presence of God in a cloud that descends upon the mountain. The next is with Elijah in 1 Kings chapter 18. When he's there again, he calls it Mount Horeb, but it's again Mount Sinai. That there, he's there and experiences the very presence of God again on a holy mountain. And so it's no wonder that when Jesus is there praying, perhaps praying for the three disciples, perhaps praying for their mission, perhaps praying that they might finally one day understand what it means for the church to be gathered together and to receive all power and authority to cast out demons, to heal the sick, to proclaim the kingdom of God. And as he prays, just like on the mountain when Moses' face was changed and transformed and began to shine forth, so we're told that the face of Jesus first was changed, and so that his face began to glow. Our faces, we're told, are signs of the Spirit. Our faces are the things that bear the imprint of the work of grace on our lives. Little babies aren't able to have much personality revealed in their faces. Jean-Paul Sartre, the atheistic French philosopher, said that around the age of 40, you're able to tell truly the character of a person by their face, because all of their decisions, all of their character is written on their face. And there's something about a person's face that reveals, have they been open to grace or have they resisted? Have they turned away from all of that? And so the face is the thing that shows something of the very presence of God. So first, it's the face of Jesus that is changed. And then all of his being, all of his clothing becomes dazzlingly white as the inner divinity of Jesus begins to shine forth for all of the disciples to see. Just as God desires that every one of us might experience something of this. And in this experience of transformation, when the divinity of Jesus begins to be revealed to the disciples, then we're told that Moses and Elijah, the law and the prophets, these two great men of God from the past who have been able to stand in the very presence of God, to be transformed by that presence, to be bearers of the mystery of God. And the disciples, even though they're sleepy, are just overwhelmed by this presence. And it's then that the cloud begins to descend. And just like in the first reading, when Abraham is told to go outside and to count the number of the stars, but he's not able to see the stars because of the brightness of the sun, so also the disciples are caught up in this cloud. The cloud that the fathers of the church tell us is a sign of the Spirit. This shining cloud that sends everything else into shadow. This cloud that fills them with fear because they know that this is an even greater and deeper sign of the presence of God. Just as the cloud covered the mountain of Mount Sinai when Moses was up there for the 40 days, so also this cloud covers this experience. In the 12th century, in the medieval church, there was this wonderful spiritual document called The Cloud of Unknowing. The author is anonymous. We don't know who wrote it, but it was this experience that sometimes the mystery of God is too great. It's too profound. It's unable to even begin to be fathomed. And it's this cloud that slowly covers the whole scene. The cloud that shields them. The cloud that prevents the mystery of God from truly being understood. Because it's too wonderful, too awesome, too amazing to be named and articulated. And yet in the midst of that experience, the disciples just were invited to be there, to be present, as God declared then to them that this is my beloved Son. Listen to him. The same words that were spoken of Jesus at his baptism, the same words that are spoken to us at our baptism, that we become the beloved children of God. We become capable of bearing this mystery. Sometimes it seems to be in the midst of cloud. Sometimes it seems to be in the midst of all of this confusion, and we're not able to open ourselves fully to what God has called us to be. But nevertheless, we're invited to just be there on the holy mountain, to be there with the Lord, to experience all that he has prepared for us. And in the midst of this season of Lent, perhaps that's all we can do. just to be there as God reminds us that as His church, He gathers us. As His church, He gives us all power and all authority to proclaim the kingdom of God, to bring release to captives, to heal the sick, to be people whose faces begin to show and reflect something of His grace and His mercy. If we are to be a Christian people this Lent, then surely our faces need to tell some of that story. Surely our faces need to show some of that sign of God's presence, of God's life, of God's healing, God's forgiveness. If a stranger comes into church today and they look around this community, what story do they see on our faces? Do they experience welcome? Do they experience forgiveness? Do they experience light and healing? Or do they see judgment and condemnation and rejection? The call of the Transfiguration is for us to be caught up in this mystery and to be changed by the presence of God among us.